Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Universal Hikers Show, Episode 2, with Landslide Bell and Tell It Like It Is, Tim. Tim, are you there? Can you hear me, or can I hear you?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, good. So we're on. Excellent. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Thanks,
sure.
Everybody. Tonight's topic is risk, examples of risk takers and what it means to take the risk and go for the adventure as it relates to this reality we call the is. So I thought I'd start with some of the people, since this is a hiker show, some of the people that have taken risks in a certain way, like the hikers and explorers of the world. Now, they've taken risks in a certain way, which is different than what we're talking about. But it is getting them out off the couch and into nature and doing something and being with nature. And last week we interviewed Tim here, and he gave us a great story about how, you know, he's been connecting to nature and all the things that can be done in nature, even making money and just, you know, taking care of it, supporting it. And that's what we're about here with the show, is we support the all-natural environment. Do you want to say anything, Tim, before I start?
Oh, go ahead, Val.
Okay. Well, I got a number of what got me started with nature and hiking was a 2014 hike with my son from Mexico to Canada on the PCT, Pacific Crest Trail. And from then on, I was addicted to it, hiking and being outdoors. And so I'm playing off that as a way to present what Dwayne the Great Rider is presenting in terms of waking up. And we start with the natural environment, you know, because that supports us all. So that's a good place where everybody, pretty much everybody, can agree upon that we need to, like, take care of it because it takes care of us. So there's a few people here that I've ran across that are interesting adventurers. This one from, his name's Brando Yelovich, and he's from New Zealand, and he's the first person that went that circumnavigated the rugged New Zealand coastline all around the perimeter. It took him 600 days. It was 5,400 miles. He called it his journey into manhood. And a lot of Indians did similar things where they went on vision quests in nature to find their spirit guide or their animal or their name or the, you know, what their purpose was in life. So this fellow hiked 5,400 miles around New Zealand, and he did a lot of other things. I mean, he also hunted on the way. There was no resupply places like there is on the Pacific Crest Trail, so he hunted for his own food. He had to take care of himself all the way through the 600 days there. That was quite an experience, I'm sure. There's Billy Goat. The Billy Goat is, right now he's probably 80 years old, but he's the heart and soul, they call it, of the Pacific Crest Trail. He was a railroad engineer when he was younger. And then when he retired, he went out, hiked the trail. Actually, he hiked the Appalachian Trail, and I think he hiked the Continental Divide Trail too, which is called the Triple Crown, hiking all three. But his favorite is the Pacific Crest Trail, and he practically lives out there for five months a year. And he goes back to New York with his girlfriend. But he's been there. He's logged in, he wanted to get, by 80 years old, he wanted to get, I think, 80,000 miles or something. I mean, it's incredible. He's just a constant professional hiker, and he lives out there. He gets anxious when he goes back into the city, gets depressed, and this is a phenomenon a lot of hikers get when they come back from prolonged period of nature. They get anxious, or they don't know what to do with themselves, because in nature you have this survival. You're more in touch with your survival and what it really takes to keep warm, feed yourself, get water, protection, and all that. So it's an interesting guy. I met him in 2014 at the kickoff in Lake Marino, California. He was there giving people advice and just giving them inspiration. He had just had an open heart surgery, so he was laying low for a while. But he's basically a couple other people I met on the trail who were former rangers, forest rangers, and they live out there. They have a pension, or they have Social Security. They come into town to collect their monthly payment there, and then they go back to the hiking, and they follow the weather, snowbird, they go back down south when it gets cold up north, and they find it rather, I met a couple of them, they're just interesting people. The idea here is that, you don't have to get off the grid and go into nature and live, but it's giving us the idea that we don't need this technology, we don't need the corruption and the distortion that we have now in society. We don't have to agree to it. And these people are demonstrations of how, you can live outside of it, yet with it, within it, at least so far. I mean, nature is being bombarded and destroyed, with the chemtrails and everything else. We got the HARP, so we'll see how long it lasts. Right now, it looks okay that, species are dying off, trees are dying, their immune system is being compromised, so the beetles get in there and chew them up and die. There's a lot of foreign substances in the soil, a lot of aluminum, so this is not great for them, their health. We'll see how long it lasts. Okay, so that's Billy Goat. Got John Muir, who is, everybody knows John Muir. He lived out in the Sierras with a blanket and bread. That's all he brought, basically, in a coat. He lived off bread and whatever he could, he had the water, it was pure at that time still, so he could drink the water. He froze to death many times almost, but he just loved it out there in the Sierras. He wrote about it in his letters and essays and books. And he helped Teddy Roosevelt, set aside some of the land as protected land, like Yosemite. So he was also had the bug, you could say. He went back to the East Bay here, where I'm at right now, San Francisco Peninsula. He lived over here in the East Bay. I think it was Berkeley or somewhere, Rinda over there. He had a house there and a wife that he just went. Nature called, and he kept on going back up there to the Sierras. And I went through there. It's just, you almost want to say it's God's country, you know, if you believe in God, which we talk about sometimes. But it's just so clean and pure and majestic. It's really something. Oh, there's Jennifer Parr Davis. She's a long-distance hiker. She's a National Geographic Adventurer of the Year. She's hiked over 14,000 miles. She's done the PCT and AT and various trails around the world. Now, I got to say that these people that are doing this full-time, they usually have an income. They're usually either writing books, giving speeches and clubs, universities, different places that will have them, you know, steer clubs, hiking clubs, outdoor clubs. They're doing, sometimes they sponsor the equipment, the gear, and they also do tours. They give tours to make money. So you can make money doing this. And Tim here is a good example too, you know, picking mushrooms during a season and then prospecting. Also, I mean, there's ways to not be bought off by the system and working a 9-to-5 job, working for the military-industrial complex. There's a few other people here mentioned. There's Grandma Gatewood. She was 70 when she hiked the Appalachian Trail, I think for the second or third time. She was the first woman who hiked the trail, the whole it's over 2,500 miles, I think, around there. It's from Georgia to Maine. That's the East Coast version of the Pacific Crest Trail. It's more like a tunnel. You got a lot of town stops that are pretty close to the trail, so you can always get off. There's Pacific Crest Trail. You've got, you know, sometimes you're a couple hundred miles away from anything, resupply or any towns. So she did that with, this is, I think, in the 50s with PF Flyers. If you remember those tennis shoes, PF Flyers, and a duffel bag, and pretty much nothing more. I mean, she didn't have the sophisticated lightweight gear that we do these days. She did it, and she did a lot of walking, and she was an inspiration to a lot of people. Along the same lines, there's the Peace Pilgrim. And this is a lady who walked from 1953 to 1981. She logged over 25,000 miles. And what she was doing was walking for a cause. So some of these people have a cause. She was walking for peace. And all she said she'd stop walking when there was peace in the world. Well, she never stopped walking, because there was never peace. And actually, she got going to a talk she was giving in a car. Somebody was taking her. There was a head-on collision with another car, and she died in the crash. So that was 1981. But during this time, all these years, almost 30 years, she would just set out with basically nothing. She'd go through cities and wildernesses and that people, she relied on people to give her food and shelter a lot of the times. She didn't beg or ask anybody, but they always, they offered, you know, finally she got a reputation and they offered her these, you know, food and sometimes, you know, stay at their house, maybe a ride someplace, the doctor or something like that. So she's in Wikipedia. She's pretty famous. Hiker, walker, you know, in this case for a cause. A lot of people get on the trails like the PCT. They're walking for cancer, walking for something, you know, walking. One lady this year's got the ashes of her husband in an urn to get, she could have spread it along the way on the trail, her husband's ashes. There's also a couple other guys I'll mention. Scott Williamson. He's here in the Santa Cruz area when he's not hiking. He's a tree. He works at a tree company. Actually, he has his own little company. And he works in the Santa Cruz. He lives in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Earns enough money during the off season, and then he goes back to the trail. And he's hiked the Pacific Crest Trail. I think it's like he lives on there too, like 12 times, 14 times. Twice he yo-yoed, meaning he walked from Mexico to Canada. And he turned around and walked back from Canada to Mexico all in one season. And he just takes it, you know, he's not a fast walker, but he puts in 14 hours. Basically, he just walks, you know, even in the evening, in the nighttime, the headlamp. He takes his snacks, you know, with small breaks. He just walks. The mileage he gets is like he could average 40 miles or more a day doing that. So I don't know if he's still out there, but he was out there when we bumped into him. He was coming from Canada to Mexico. We were in Washington. We were going north and he was going south, and we bumped into him. He talked to us a little bit. He's just a regular guy. He's just, again, he's addicted to this, you know, simple lifestyle where all you do is eat, sleep, and walk, basically. There's no bills to pay or, you know, worries other than just staying warm and, you know, getting enough food. And basically, the three activities are just sleeping, walking, and eating. And he's also... what can I say about him? Well, I'll just leave him. And the last fellow is Andrew Skirka. And he's got quite a reputation too. He did this Alaskan route a number of years ago. Tim, you would know, but I don't have it in front of me, but he went down and he went up the coast and around and he went through some of the well-known areas, and then he I think I can't remember, 8 months or maybe longer. And it's like that guy we met in Alaska who did the sled adventure. He had a raft. Andrew Skirka had a raft. He had skis. And he had those. He didn't use a snowmobile, but he used skis and a raft sometimes to ford rivers and waterways. One of these small routes that you can take. So he's done that. He leads the tours in Alaska and other places. He sponsors equipment, so he makes money. And, you know, again, he started off as a financial consultant and got tired of it he took his first hike and he was hooked. So all these people are examples and demonstrations that there's a lot of things that is going on here. They're demonstrating how nature is so cool. I mean, people get hooked on it. I came across the pioneer days when the settlers were moving out west, and sometimes the Indians would attack the settlers, and they'd steal the women and children. They didn't kill them, they'd steal them and use them as trade them or make them part of their tribe. In this little particular YouTube video was about 12 children that were adopted by the Indians, and they didn't want to go back when the parents found them. They didn't want to go back. And that kind of also demonstrates how living with nature, you know, has a lot of benefits. It has a lot of, you can get a lot from it. I mean, it's a step toward becoming more aware. There's also the Syrians. They're off planet. They're very one with their planet. I mean, they also do not recognize the is. Maybe some of them do, but they live with nature, but they're not recognized. There's so much. There's more than just that. They do recognize the importance of nature. They're very intuitive with their planet. I mean, the planet talks to them, and they communicate telepathically with the planet. And they get, you know, when they need food, the planet will show them where the food is. So it can be done, that part of it. I mean, we can change things here on this planet with agreement to where we don't have this technology that's poisoning and destroying everything in sight. That we're geared for the theme is taking a risk and starting the adventure. So these people I talked about, you know, they went into the unknown, basically. I mean, there's trails and stuff, like Andrew Skirka in Alaska, there were no trails. I mean, you know, Tim, you know Alaska, there's of course, no man has walked ever. It's so remote. So he took the risk. You know, in a sense, people can use the outdoors to find themselves to a certain extent, or to see where they're at. Some people do that. They go out and say, you know, my life is a mess. I want to go see what I can find of myself. That's another thing that happens outdoors. You have a lot of time to think. But what we're presenting here with the new presentation, in this case, Universal Hikers Episode 2, is taking a risk and seeing beyond what you know and what you think you know, and going into the unknown. And this would mean, in a way, not necessarily going out into the wilderness, but just singing the new you and before bed or during the day, the sound we use, the new you, and watching your dreams and listening to the guidance guides will give you and life will give you. So I'll leave it at that. Tim, you can chime in here if you want.
Yeah, all right. I was thinking about the adventurers you were talking about, and we have some in our southwestern Oregon history here too. And I'll mention one gal whose name was Eula Morrison, and she was called an adventurist. And this was in the early days when the white people were exploring this part of the country. this part of the world. And the story goes that Eula took off from a place that was one of those original little communities for the miners on Josephine Creek, where gold was discovered in Oregon at the mouth of Day's Gulch, where it hits Josephine Creek. So there was a little community of miners that had a place called Kirby or Kirbyville. But Eula somehow took off from, was part of that group that had traveled to this unknown area, unknown to the white people. And she took off and went out into an area that it's called the Calamiopsis Wilderness now. And it's pretty rugged country. The mountains aren't giant like the Alaska Range or as high as the Sierras, or they're like the highest is 5,000 feet. But it's very broken up country, very up and down and steep country. Lots of beautiful creeks from springs and. But anyway, Eula went out into that country in those beginning exploration days for the white people, and she found a face of a cliff that was quartz and gold, and she would bring it, the quartz and gold, back into Kirby, and she had mules, I guess it was, and the story goes she left diamond-shaped markings on in the rock or something to into that rugged country to so she would be able to return, and she would go out with her mules and bring back this beautiful gold stone, and it was the richest gold stone, still is, on record in Oregon. John Day in Eastern Oregon or Central Oregon was the rich, the next richest, and he was the richest man in Oregon in the original days. But Eula's ore was the richest that was ever found right out here in our Calamiopsis Wilderness area between Kirby and the Oregon coast, which, as the crow flies, it's about 30. Some miles of no road still, and it's pretty much untouched country, pretty rough country to explore, because in the summer it's real hot and there's the scorpions and rattlesnakes, but that was a story about one gal that was an adventurist and found the richest gold stone in Oregon. And she ended up going out from Kirby on her last trip, and she never came back to Kirby. So nobody knew what happened to her, whether she just took her gold with her mules and went all the way to the coast and took a ship somewhere else on Earth or what. But she got to find gold by her adventure of out looking at the country and seeing what was there. And there's another person that still is out in that country. I think his name's Chetco Bob. It might be something else. It might be Chetco Jim, but I met him just one time. But he's pretty much stays out in that wilderness area. And so I guess he probably knows it better than anyone else, because it sounds like he just hikes all over out there in the wilderness, no trails and no roads or anything, by himself. Of course, we don't have beavers in that area. And even when you're an adventurist, you still have to have some guidance, because in certain areas you don't want to drink the water because beavers may be upstream and they pollute the water, and you can get beaver fever or bears wallow in the water. So you do have to be careful of your water, but nowadays we can purify our water, or otherwise you'd practically need to drink the spring water, or at least make sure that there's nothing dead upstream from you for a ways or anything like that in the nice creeks. Because it's just natural that salamanders and crawdads, and because there's otters that eat things and fish, and there's parts of them, and of course they have to go to the bathroom too, and that things do get into the water. So, but when we think about this adventure and people that go out into those countries, it seems like it would make sense to me that it would be part of an education for the humans of this planet to spend some time out in the natural environment, to get to see how the animals that you run into act, and hear the birds and the sounds in the evening of the creeks or the wind. And because when it comes down to survival in this physical, anything seems like it can happen, whether it's earthquakes or whether it's a comet or something like that, that has a drastic effect on our environment, or earthquakes that just bust up everything and the roads are no longer passable, and maybe dams have broken and the gas lines are broken, and the airports are tore up. So anytime a person should be able to have some survival skills, to be able to know what berries to eat and things like that, and how to catch a fish in the creek, or different ways of being able to survive in the case of something catastrophic taking place on the part of the earth, at least that a person's in. It seems like things happen all over the place, whether it's volcanoes or earthquakes or coastal tsunamis or things like that. So, and it would seem like part of being prepared to survive, to deal with this physical stuff that takes place, and that it would be make sense to become a little bit familiar with nature, to be able to actually be able to live with nature, so that you don't just suffer and die if you're out forced into a natural condition to survive.
We'll set something like this up in the Nations United University. So this is what you're talking about. This makes sense to be able to survive, you know, if you find yourself outdoors, and especially, you know, getting shelter and just preventing hypothermia, and get out of the rain or, you know, snow, and just getting yourself kind of protected first, and then and go forward with other essentials like water, and food, fire. So it makes sense. There's a couple. You mentioned mules, and I thought I'd mention three more famous explorers, and one is Kit Carson. He was a small in stature. When people saw him, they didn't believe he was Kit Carson. They'd say, "You're not Kit Carson." They wouldn't believe him because I think he was only 5'6", or he might have been even shorter. But he was sinewy, strong. He sure knew his stuff. I mean, he had a sense about the areas that he went through. He was eventually called upon to be a guide. John Fremont called him to be the scout for exploration and the mapping of California, and I think up there too, northwest. John Fremont and Kit Carson had a good friendship, and they respected each other's abilities. So Kit never had, he never lacked any work, you'd say. He was also a general in the Mexican-American War. He was also a native, kind of a, how you call it, Indian Affairs agent, or and this is where things got a little sour for him. He was told with orders to move these people, kind of the Trail of Tears idea, where he had to move the Navajos off their land and into a reservation, thousands and thousands of them, and thousands died on the way. And they still never forgave him for that, the Indians, you know, the Navajos. He generally had a good relationship with Indians, but that one went sour because he was torn between following orders and you know, he's a pretty responsible guy. He always, you know, obey orders. But this one he really questioned, but he still did it. So here's an opportunity for him to, he could have made a better choice, because a lot of people were suffered and they actually died. A lot of them died because of this governmental edict. But he's a courier too. He rode back and forth, I think at least twice, I think maybe three times, from West Coast to Washington, D.C. on a mule. Mules are more dependable than a horse, and faster than a walking. So he preferred mule, and he carried messages back to D.C. and back and forth, because he knew the land. He could get there quicker than anybody, practically. He's one fellow that comes to mind, and then there's Admiral Byrd, the polar explorer, who supposedly he was the first one who explored the North and South Pole by air. And actually, he left a diary explaining how he met these tall whites in Antarctica. He was flying through the area, and this kind of goes along with the flat earth idea. There's people living in Antarctica. He started seeing trees and greenery. You know, this is a frozen wasteland. And then his radar stopped, his instruments stopped working, and he was led down to plane was led down to somebody else's control, and landed, and the tall whites came meet and greet him, and they told him, you know, we respect you, you know, we think you're honest, we honor you, you know, you should go back and tell the people. There's, you know, Earth isn't doing too well. It's impinging on us too, you know, on their lifestyle, that all the toxicity and all that. They have technology, but still, you know, they're living on the earth in this area, Antarctic area. So he was able to meet with these people, and he left a diary about that. It's kind of interesting. It's not really well publicized because the government didn't want that part of it to come out. But a bit of it did come out, and people are aware of it. And then there's somebody else. Let's see. I forget. There's another person. They'll remember. That. Go ahead, Tim. We'll get you off. We'll get you off. I know you have a 7 o'clock appointment, so we'll get you
off. Yeah, I was just thinking about how important it is to have some guidance about how to live in the different places on the earth. If you happen to be, you know, somehow broke down in the desert and it's hot and things, a person's mouth will dry out very fast. If he's out there very long without water, but all a person needs to do for a temporary moisturizing of the mouth and lips and stuff is put a pebble in your mouth, and that'll keep the body producing an amount of saliva instead of it getting all cracked and dried out. If a person is trying to have to cross some hot area for very long, the importance of the adventure of life is like a person pretty thankful to get to experience the smells of nature, like the pine trees have a scent and fir trees and there's wild flowers in places and all kinds of different things that are much different than it seems like in the densely populated areas of Earth. People seem to congregate in the masses in certain areas. And it's interesting, too, how they seem to use some of the best of the earth, the fertilest, most beautiful earth for the building on and stuff, when that is actually the area where it grows the food the best, the beautiful valleys and stuff. That material has taken a long time to develop into the dirt and flattens out in many places, so it's very fertile, but people just cover it up with houses and streets and all kinds of shopping centers, and it's just what it seems like we earthlings don't really have much guidance. We have to find stuff out on our own about what makes sense. It seems like we make so many mistakes with so much of the stuff we do. And now we're looking at this earth being all polluted from our trash, like plastics and all these drugs that get into the water, besides like Fukushima on our planet Earth, and it just keeps dumping, and it just doesn't make sense that man doesn't put out all countries unite and contain the stuff, all join together and prevent the poisons from getting into our ocean, and the way we handle our trash too makes terrible spots for the earth to deal with for a long, long time. It concentrate all this garbage in one area when there's so much that can be reused instead of going into certain spots on the earth. It would be like the human body having certain poison put over and over and over again right onto the same spot. How long does it take to have a big effect in the water of that area where this garbage is being put, and it's just so many things that are going on with our air. We've got all these vehicles all over the earth putting the carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide from the exhaust of the cars and the planes and the boats and the trains, and here's the very air that without it we don't even last 5 minutes about without the air. These physical bodies just have to have air, and then we get all this
Yes, it's a daunting challenge we have here. We're not trying to save the world, but just you know, it's the wake up. The awareness will bring about its own better choices from people, and then we can create, you know, how we like it. But it's not about change; it's about becoming more aware. There's two other little stories I have here. Is the Lewis and Clark? That's the one I was trying to remember. These fellows also complimented each other, like Fremont and Carson. Lewis, Meriwether Lewis, was the geek guy. He was out there to, you know, the plants and the animals to identify and journal everything that he saw. He was also a good navigator, I believe. Clark was better with the men and with the Indians and with logistics, etc. So they complemented each other. And they took the risk. President Jefferson asked them to go out there and find a waterway passage to the Pacific from the Missouri on. They never did. But they found other things. You know, they did open up the West. They're also asked to, again, make friends with the Indians, basically kind of just set that up so when the pioneers come, it'll be a little easier. So that, finding a waterway to the Pacific, and then to note all the plants and animals, etc. So they took, you know, I'm just surprised not there was about 35 or so of them. All of them came back, except this one guy who got appendicitis. He died, but all of them came back through all their hardships, you know, through the Indians and through the weather. They almost didn't make it over the Rockies. The Sacagawea, I guess she helped them there with the Indians there, helped them shelter and food. So they didn't get stuck during the winter and freeze and starve to death. So without the help of Indians, again, it would have been a lost expedition. The last story is with Dwayne the Great Writer. He took the risk. He's telling us, you know, he had a wife, a good job. He was well off. He had a nice house in Huntington Beach. But, you know, the wife didn't want to go any further. He was being shown by Reb Zartars and Paul Twitchell and other real guides that there's a lot more. So he decided to leave, go into the unknown, basically, you know, leave his happy home, which he had everything he needed. And you know, there's a time there where he was, it was hard, very hard for him, financially and otherwise. So he took the risk in his own way. That's what I mean about, it's not just going out into the wilderness, but going through yourself or looking at yourself. He saw that there was more. The wife didn't want to come along, so he decided, well, he's got to do it himself, then. He's got to go. And same with us. If we're not followers or members or anything like that, but in a sense, Dwayne the Great Writer, Paul Twitchell, Reb Zartars, guides, They point the way. They give us references. We're not following them, but we are watching them. We're watching them, and you know, they're in a sense role models. You know, in terms of how to get through this matrix and how to make better choices, how to be become more aware. And we're very fortunate to have Dwayne in the physical here, because a lot of the guides were gotten rid of. They don't want us here, so he's here in the physical, and we can talk to him. People can actually talk to him. He can help interpret their dreams. He can give them, you know, point the way, listen to his Facebook groups, read his Facebook groups, read his books. You can see him on the real side if you sing the new you sound. And it's a wonderful opportunity for everybody here at this point in history.
Quite an adventure when a person's ready to have the opportunity with some real guidance from real guides to explore these other realms besides this physical realm. We hear of a causal realm and an astral realm and a mental realm, and we hear of a real universe where everyone is free, real freedom, instead of being controlled by where we can go and what we can do in this physical realm by all these authoritarians or brutalitarians that seem to have caused so much problems for all of us humans, with creating wars for their own benefit and all kinds of things in this physical realm that we can only offer to share what we've seen and heard, our experiences about the adventure, the possibilities of not having to return into the physical realm, where at any time it can be blown to pieces or other ways end. So we have a real thankfulness for some real guidance and a real education about more than we know of here in this physical realm. And the connections that's being offered by Dwayne to start with is to sing the song New You. And if a person's sincere, sing it before you go to sleep for a while, and in the morning when you wake up, then maybe the real guides will come into your dreams and you'll find a way to earn your way out of this physical into a place that we can't even imagine how wonderful it is.
Thanks, Tim. That's great. Yeah, the adventure continues. It's you know, you can be in this world but not be of it. We've heard that before, but it's really a reality. Once you start this adventure with the new you, you can be here, but you can, through your imagination, you start off with that, you just go and go and recognize more and more of what's going on. It's quite something. It's nothing like you would ever consider. So take the risk, get on the adventure, and we'll see you out there on the real side, maybe.
Yeah, a wonderful opportunity. It's not trying to convince anybody of something. It's just being sharing something to test for yourself. If you think that it's something that you might want to find out about other realms, places in life, Good talking with you again, Val. I guess I got to do a Facebook Live.
Okay, Tim. I'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
See ya.
Bye.